Before we dive into this episode, I just want to share a quick note about a new offering that I have on the horizon. In just a few weeks, I'm going to be opening registration for Kiln, a brand new community and creative incubator for conscious, creative folks like yourself. If you have a creative project or maybe a business idea that you have been struggling to move forward, if you are transitioning between careers or on the cusp of a reinvention, or if you're just feeling the call of an intuition or a new creative path that wants to be explored, then this is the catalyst and the community for you. Kiln is all about helping you find the clarity, the motivation, and the momentum that you need to really follow through on your creative yearnings. We will be gathering regularly for alchemy coaching sessions with yours truly. We will be having deep dive retreat days, and we will also be gathering for weekly co-creation sessions. And all of this is really designed to keep your creativity fired up and on track. With Kiln, I'm really building the creative community that I have always longed for, and I honestly can't wait to share more with y'all. Kiln is going to launch in April, and registration will open in mid-March. If this is something that sounds like it's up your alley, you can visit the teaser page at jkg.co/kiln. That's jkg.co/KILN. And you can share your email with me, and I will send you more details in just a few weeks when registration opens. So stay tuned. I'm Jocelyn K. Gly, and this is Hurry Slowly, a podcast about creativity, consciousness, and healing. Today, I am in conversation with my dear friend and frequent podcast guest, Sebene Selassie, who describes herself as a paradox peddler, a student of mystery, a lying down meditator, a living room dancer, a collage artist, and a nerdy immigrant weirdo. For those of you who are not familiar with her work, Sebene is the author of the wonderful book, You Belong, A Call for Connection, which explores spirituality and humanity through the lens of belonging. Though she penned it a few years ago, I have to say that You Belong and its focus on demystifying the delusion of separation feels particularly relevant in this moment of quite extreme polarization in our society. So definitely worth a read if you haven't picked it up before. Sebene also writes one of my favorite Substack newsletters called Ancestors to Elements, which investigates the central paradox of being human, as she describes it, that we are not separate and we are not the same. Now, lately, I have really been reflecting on the role of the seasons, of rhythms, of taking breaks, of allowing one's ideas time to gestate. I talked a bit about that on the most recent podcast before this one, The Tyranny of Urgency, and I wanted to examine all that a little bit more closely with Sebene, who is a writer whose authentic voice I really admire. When we recorded this conversation, Sebene was just returning from a month-long trip to New Zealand. So we talk about exploring self-reliance and sovereignty through solo travel and the benefits of breaking free from your usual routine. We also discuss the power of acknowledging what one has accomplished and how one has evolved in a culture that tries to make us feel like we're always behind. And we also delve into a chat about the rhythms of creativity, how to lean into one's natural voice, and why we get so focused on the negative aspects of our performance rather than, as Sebene says, going towards the love. I really hope that you find this conversation as nourishing as I did. Let's go ahead and dive in. Sebene, welcome to Hurry Slowly. It's so good to have you back.
Jocelyn, thank you for having me. It's good to be back.
I don't think a season of Hurry Slowly would be complete without you at this point.
Oh, that's a huge honor. Thank you.
So recently I have been thinking about the power of acknowledgement and how our collective obsession with productivity really tends to pull us away from it because we put most of our focus on what's next or what we've not accomplished, which then makes us feel like we're always behind. And I've been reflecting on how acknowledgement, you know, recognizing what we've done, what has happened, even how our consciousness has shifted, just thinking about how much peace that can bring. And you were telling me recently about a ritual that you did to acknowledge how much had happened for you in the past year, in 2023, how much you had to hold, how much you moved through. Would you be willing to share what that ritual looked like and how it came up for you?
Sure, yeah. I want to give credit to Amelia Herbie and Mary Grace Elridge, who led a course last year called Living Systems. And I know that you know both of them and have worked especially with Amelia before. And in that class, which was all about creating healthy, elements-based, earth-rooted systems for our work lives and our live lives, there was a lot of attention given to closing rituals for the week, for the month, for the season, and for the year, which many of us don't pay attention to. So we'll like often start Monday morning with, sort of our plan for the week, but we don't necessarily, I don't necessarily, and many people in the class seem to be this way too, like close out the week with an acknowledgement of what we'd have accomplished. So I have to say, I didn't really tune into that invitation or instruction until the end of the year. And for the end of the year ritual, they invited us to do that, to look at each month or each season or however we wanted to parse it out. And so I did that. I did do a month by month acknowledgement of kind of what happened, you know, and I had to sometimes look back at my Google Calendar and, see what had happened, what I'd done. And I tend to put a lot of things in my calendar, not only the appointments that I have, but if I have like a hospital stint, which I had three of last year, I put that into the calendar so that I can remember the dates later on and, you know, understand kind of the patterns that were happening for me. So I looked back and month by month, I acknowledged both the challenges, but also especially celebrated my accomplishments. And it was really beautiful. It was a really wonderful way to end the year and to begin to plan for the new one.
I love that focus on closing rituals. And it's also reminding me how important, you know, you made that note about putting milestones or certain things into your calendar. I do quite a bit of journaling. So most of, you know, the big events in my life get captured there. And I think there's something really important about having that documentation so that you can go back and review, because otherwise it's really difficult to even remember what happened and when those specific milestones were. So I think there's something in there too about how valuable it is to have some sort of practice where you are documenting what's unfolding for you, whether that's in a journal or on a calendar or through some other means.
Yeah, and I just thinking about that, sort of making sure to document, one of the things I do put in my calendar are visitors. That for me is also just to keep track of who's staying here and how much laundry I have to do. And that was a really beautiful thing to record at the end of the year too. And just to see all of these relationships and, you know, then jog my memory for what we did during those times or, you know, where we went and could add that to the list. And so there's so many layers of it that, don't have to do only with just quote unquote work milestones or our businesses, but you know, the business of life. Life in our lives.
100%. And I have a practice in that vein. My usual ritual is not to make New Year's resolutions, but to instead look backwards and to acknowledge all of the ways in which I've grown in the past year. So really kind of looking at how to acknowledge spiritual or consciousness, or, you know, maybe even the way I'm taking care of my body or my diet or those types of things, to acknowledge those shifts, because I think they can be so ephemeral and it's so easy not to notice or acknowledge those types of evolutions because we are so focused on the really tangible elements of work and of business and so forth.
That's really cool. I love that.
So my understanding is that you did that exercise. You and I were talking recently, and it sounds like you did that while you were on a month-long trip that you took by yourself to New Zealand. And I have a practice of doing quite a bit of travel alone as well. And I'm 46 years old now, and my experience is that most people seem to find a middle-aged woman traveling alone to be a bit of an oddity. And that's true for both people who I know, friends, as well as random people that I encounter. I find that people tend to get worried on my behalf or to find it strange that I'm traveling alone. But I really love traveling alone. And at the same time, there's something about it where it's never quite as fun as I expect it to be. I often talk on this podcast and in my courses about this liminal space of the creative process being one of generative discomfort. And I feel like that's what traveling alone is for me, a space of generative discomfort in a certain sense. I'm curious, what was your experience of the benefits and maybe also the drawbacks of taking a good chunk of time out to travel alone?
Oh, first of all, I'm so interested by this idea of like people being worried for you somehow or concerned about you. I didn't find that. Like, I'm just, can I ask you, like, how does that show up?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's, at the root, it seems like a basic, you know, safety type of thing. Well, there's a few layers to it. I mean, I think one, many people don't relate to traveling somewhere, you know, without a companion or where you'll know someone. So I went to Australia by myself, and I remember when I did that, there were so many people who just thought it was strange that I was going by myself. I think they just couldn't relate to it. You know, they hadn't traveled alone. It seemed probably like it would be maybe a little scary or uncomfortable. But then there's definitely a safety piece as well. I did a trip in 2019 where I traveled alone by myself for 3 weeks. And one of the places that I went was to Joshua Tree. And I was out in Joshua Tree National Park out in California. And it was July. So it was really, really hot during the days. Like, it would be like 105 during the days. And I was doing a lot of hiking alone by myself. So I'd have to get up really early to go hiking before it got really hot. And there's a real, when you're in the desert, you know, you really have to be safe if you're hiking alone when it's going to be 105 degrees in the desert during the day. Because if you get lost, you really will be in serious trouble. And it is really easy to get lost in the desert. But I remember I went into a gift shop there, and there were some women who owned the gift shop who were there, and I told them that I was traveling alone. And then they proceeded to tell me this story about this woman who'd been hiking alone in Joshua Tree National Park, who had like fallen down, you know, I don't know, like into a hole or a canyon or something like that.
Oh my God.
Broken her
who
pelvis.
Does that?
Then had to drink her own urine to survive. And she did survive. She made it out. She was okay. But, you know, that was the story that I got. And I was kind of like, okay, well, That was helpful. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Oh my goodness. That's really not kind.
Well, I think we have so much media, right, that really reinforces women's ability to come to harm, right? There's so much TV shows and murder podcasts and all of these things that just really emphasize our unsafety. And so there's this kind of weird tendency, I think, to think about that and to even reflect back stories like that sometimes.
That's so funny. You know, I hadn't traveled alone, you know, and when I say that, I mean like solo travel, not just traveling to visit people or for a weekend getaway, but really a substantial amount of time in a different place with the deliberate choice to be on your own. So I hadn't done that kind of intentional solo travel since my late 20s, early 30s. When I traveled through Southeast Asia, I also did some travel in Africa on my own. And I remember encountering many solo travelers at that time, and many who were younger than me, who had, you know, just graduated college, or even some who had just graduated high school. They're usually Europeans or Australians, where that kind of thing is more common, where it's just sort of almost expected that you at some point go off in the world and possibly on your own or with one friend. But I, you know, I felt sort of like, oh, I wish I'd done more of this. And I hadn't done any of it for, you know, going almost to 25 years now later at the age of 53. So I had had a template for traveling alone. And I assumed that I would encounter a lot of younger travelers traveling alone, because when I did travel by myself back then, I didn't encounter that many people older than me. A few, but not many. I mean, you know, partly because of just time and circumstances of what older people are up to as compared to younger people. But I do remember encountering some older folks when I was traveling, and how, you know, there are things that I remember about those encounters, things that were said to me that still to this day are, you know, considerations that I have in my mind. So I was like, oh, I get to be the wise older person now. Yeah. And I really enjoyed, I was especially at this one, I traveled in different ways in this month. So I was sometimes staying in hostels, sometimes staying in hotels because I was fed up with hostels and, you know, used my my points and the advantages of being an older person with travel points to stay in a hotel and just get a good night's sleep and hot shower in my own bathroom. And so I was sometimes encountering more people than other times, but I did a yoga retreat for 5 days that was full of young travelers. And it was so cool to meet these young people, especially young women who were just venturing out on their own. And there were a number of young women between the ages of, you know, 21 and let's say 35, who were taking off on these adventures for 6 months, a year, one woman, 4 years. And many of them were living in these camper vans, which is something that a lot of young people do in New Zealand. And they, if they're coming from another country, they often get this work visa. I think it's called the holiday, working holiday. So you can come from somewhere else and work in New Zealand for up to 18 months. And they'll buy a camper van when they arrive and then sell it when they leave. And I think most of the young women I met at this retreat from all over the world, from Czechoslovakia and French Canada and other parts of Europe and from Australia, were doing this. They were driving around the country in these camper vans on their own. So, you know, I don't think I was such an oddity, maybe because I was a older Black woman traveling by herself, but the traveling by yourself wasn't the oddity in that situation.
And what was your experience of kind of the benefits of traveling alone, and or just the drawbacks of traveling alone?
Yeah, when you were talking about sort of the generative discomfort, you know, some of it is a discomfort that I would feel in any month of my life, you know, moments of boredom or loneliness or frustration. I think the drawback of traveling on my own is, especially because I wasn't doing any conversations with friends. So I was texting a bit to stay in touch with people. Two of my friends were tracking where I was just to make sure that someone knew where I was all the time. But besides that, I wasn't in, you know, deeper contact with folks, which meant that I didn't have a certain amount of depth to my interactions with people, and that can be kind of lonely. And especially in terms of humor, I sort of would laugh to myself a lot. And there was one person actually on the yoga retreat who was very funny and with whom I got along really well. And we laughed a lot together. But except for those few days, you know, I didn't have a lot of just genuine laughter and connection that comes from knowing someone well or having the same kind of humor and, you know, that realizing how rare that can be and also understanding how important that is to me. So that, you know, when you spoke about kind of the loneliness, that's what comes up for me is like not having that kind of connection of someone who really gets you. Or being surrounded by people who really get you. But the benefits were so much. I mean, I was just felt so proud of myself, first of all, especially because I was coming off a year of being separated from my soon-to-be ex-husband. We're going through a divorce right now. And, you know, I'd spent the year on my own in New York, but this was my first kind of big trip without him and a really kind of important milestone for me. I filed for divorce on Friday and I left for New Zealand on Monday. So that felt really important and significant as a, you know, step into sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was also experimenting with treating this as a creative retreat in a way and doing a lot of contemplating and reading and kind of digesting in terms of the space around me. So I was reading books about New Zealand and watching films set in New Zealand and then just being in New Zealand and learning about the country and then writing about that and what it was bringing up for me. And that was really a cool experiment that I would like to try in different ways in different places.
Mm. And I'm curious about the kind of knock-on effects as well. I know when I have done longer stints of traveling by myself, which I do with pretty good frequency, often there's something significant that occurs or kind of opens up as a result from it. So for instance, in 2018, when I went on that 3-week trip where I was just doing a lot of hiking alone by myself that I mentioned before in the desert and other places as well, a few weeks after I got back from that retreat was when I ended up kind of having this intuition about moving upstate, which I've talked about on the podcast before. I had this intuition about moving upstate and then ended up acting on it and, ended up buying a house upstate about 6 months before the pandemic started. And so I didn't really understand what was happening at the time, but it turned out to be a really good intuition. So that's one example. Another example is I just went away for a month last year. And then when I got back, me and my partner ended up breaking up. So that was a sort of less positive outcome. But in both of these instances, I think there was, you know, there were kind of shifts and maybe even a certain spaciousness and just a deeper connection to myself, a deeper tuning into myself that was able to happen as a result of spending so much time alone and maybe even also, you know, just spending time in a unfamiliar place. And I'm curious if you've experienced any of that, any kind of knock-on effects maybe afterwards.
Yeah, I would say, you know, during and afterwards, this sense of sovereignty that you and I have talked about before, that I've been exploring since my split, I think really sort of required me to leave the apartment that I'd shared with my ex for the dozen years before and live out of a bag for a month, you know, a pretty small backpack. And just the self-reliance and kind of the understanding that I have everything that I need right here within me was really powerful and empowering. And now being back in my beautiful apartment and space and really appreciating that, but knowing that I can count on myself in that way was really powerful. Another thing that I didn't really understand why I was going to New Zealand, it was sort of a somewhat random choice in terms of going away at the end of the year, which is something I knew I wanted to do. And was planning for the year, but I thought I was actually going to go somewhere else. And because of a series of events that were unexpected, I ended up going where I did. And I knew that there was a reason for that, and I wasn't quite sure why. I had been thinking about, what my next book would be for quite a while. And knowing that I wanted to explore something about my family and where I'm from, and the cultures I come from in Ethiopia and Eritrea, and thinking about writing a hybrid memoir about sort of the empires that I come from and the loss of connection to our indigeneity that preceded colonialism, because well, first of all, Ethiopia was never colonized, but that, you know, we often blame a lot of things on colonialism, which is right to do, but the cultures I come from have a lot of hierarchy and imperialistic tendencies that predate European contact, and a lot of oppressions that exist within the various cultures and ethnicities that are there. And going to New Zealand, I started really considering this idea of indigeneity in a different way as I encountered the Maori culture and recognized that the Maori have been in Aotearoa. I hope I'm saying that right, but that's the original name for New Zealand, for about 800 to 1,000 years. Meanwhile, my peoples have been on that land since the beginning of people. So we're like the indigenous of the indigenous. But even when I mentioned this idea to my dad, he was like, yeah, we're not indigenous. You know, we've sort of lost our connection to land in that way of really being in harmony, being connected to stories and to myths and understanding that connect us to all of nature and to the seasons and to the animals and to the land itself, and learning a bit about Maori culture and reading the tales and understanding a little bit more about their culture, although it's just the tip of the iceberg, made me realize that I want to delve into this idea of indigeneity even more and understand, you know, where does it start and how does it stay intact, and how do we come back to that harmony with land and place? So it was interesting to like not know why I was there and then uncover why I was there while I was there.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I want to kind of pull that thread and follow up on kind of connection to land and to seasonality and even to how that moves into creative rhythms in a minute. But I want to just pause for a second to go back to something you said at the beginning there. Well, two points, really. One, to just affirm and really reflect as well for myself that feeling of self-reliance that is also was something that came up really strongly for me out of traveling alone, and maybe particularly as a woman. Another trip that I did was in 2022. I drove cross country with my dog and we camped the whole way. And yeah, doing those things, you know, camping solo, which I'd never done before, you know, hiking through the desert solo, really beautiful to connect with that feeling, as you said, of kind of self-trust and self-reliance. But the other word that you used was sovereignty, which is a word that you and I in our kind of personal dialogue and personal relationship have been talking a lot about lately, and I think both of us are very interested in, but it's not a word that people use a lot or people talk about very much. I'm just curious if you could kind of illuminate what you mean when you say sovereignty and kind of what you are thinking about with regard to that term and with regard to maybe kind of reclaiming it.
Yeah, it's funny. I can't remember who I was talking to, and I mentioned this word, and then they kind of switched to using autonomy. Mm-hmm. And I don't see them as the same. There's something mm-hmm. about autonomy to me that is disconnecting and is more isolating. Mm-hmm. And this might be, you know, my semantic lens on it, but to me, sovereignty is describing my capacity to be not so much self-reliant, although that can come up as part of the process, mm-hmm. because I still value being interconnected, to being, you know, really rooted in community and friendship and relationship. But sovereignty to me is this unwinding from the need for codependency. You know, having been in a fairly unhealthy dynamic, and in some ways a healthy dynamic, you know, I was married for 14 years and there's a lot of goodness there, but there were patterns of being dependent on someone in ways that were really damaging my capacity to speak up for myself, to you know, ask for what I need, to draw boundaries when needed. And so sovereignty to me is being fully in reign of myself, like mm-hmm. reign is in the word. So it's like I have this sense of being clear about who I am and what my boundaries are and what I need, and to be in relationship with another with that clarity.
Yeah, 100%. And I agree with you on the sovereignty versus autonomy difference. I was trying to get a handle on how they feel different to me. And yeah, it's something about autonomy that just feels a little bit more mechanical to me as well. Just even the sound of the word, whereas sovereignty feels more spiritual to me somehow. But it's funny, you were saying unwinding from codependency, which is also part of how I think about it. But I was thinking about it as like collecting my energy, you know, kind of collecting and gathering all of my energy up and really kind of holding it for myself and drawing on those reserves for myself, if that makes sense. So I really feel it in kind of an energetic way, really thinking about energetic sovereignty and what does that mean to not be sort of too plugged into or too intertwined with other people, which is, of course, you know, one way of saying codependency. Mm-hmm. So to kind of loop back to that thread you were opening up, thinking about connecting, reconnecting to seasonality, reconnecting to those rhythms. I've been talking about that quite a bit on the show lately, thinking about creative rhythms, thinking about seasonality, and reflecting on how at this particular time of year, it's very common for me to be in sort of a hibernation or a kind of behind the scenes gestation in my creative process. And I'm curious what you are discovering about or maybe tuning into with regard to your own creative rhythms lately.
I've been thinking about this for quite some time, And trying to unplug from the systems that would have me be busier at times of year when I know I shouldn't be busy. So, for example, I used to teach Thanksgiving and New Year's retreats in the past, and started saying no to those retreats, which were often quite lucrative, because I know those are not the times of year where I want to be in front of, you know, 100 of people and, in a week long process. It's quite exhausting and taxing, and starting to design my year so that I'm really following the rhythms of the energies, where I happen to live in the Northern Hemisphere. So this year I wrapped up my work by Thanksgiving and sort of took care of other things towards the end of the year before I left for this trip in December, and made sure that I wasn't coming back to a full plate, and sort of had a nice kind of landing space on my return, and picking up in a sort of steady way in terms of my work as I head into the spring, which is when I will sort of maybe start to have more things going on in line with our true new year, which is the equinox. Sort of really tuning in to the rhythms of nature and to the seasons to align my body and my energy with those of the sun and the moon and the planets.
And how would you say that feels so far, having made that shift? Obviously, there are very different things happening in your life at this time this year as opposed to this time last year, but I'm curious if you have a felt sense at all, kind of in the body, in the mind, of how making those adaptations is impacting you.
Yeah, it definitely feels right. And even if, you know, last year I couldn't follow these rhythms quite the same way because of what was going on with me personally, this is something, again, that I've been thinking about and sort of orienting myself towards for a few years, and trying to get out of the rhythm of the larger culture, which is really not in line seasonally. I mean, the way our year is structured is really bananas, you know, in terms of everyone getting really, really busy towards the end of the year. I learned from a friend of mine who had a heart condition of some years ago now, and she had what is called holiday heart. So she landed in the hospital with heart palpitations that were quite serious. But she learned through that the highest number of heart attack deaths happen on Christmas, and the second highest happen on New Year's, and they call it holiday heart because of the stress and the food and the alcohol and, you know, all that comes with sort of the end of the year indulgences. But it's largely stress, and hers was related to family stress directly. And it's just, you know, fascinating that we are so out of touch and out of tune that at the time of year when everything else in nature is tending towards rest and sleep and even demise, you know, for a later rebirth, we have our busiest time of the year. You know, most people are really, really busy at the end of the year, you know, starting from Thanksgiving all the way through the new year. So yes, I definitely feel the difference of aligning to the rhythms. And this year specifically, I'm really thankful for the forethought and the planning I put into this. And I've added to that, and I know you connect with this as well, my studies of astrology. And so then also aligning to moon transits as well as other planetary transits in how I kind of live my year out.
That's really beautiful. I did not know about holiday heart, but I did know, or I've read, that one of the other kind of peak times for heart incidents is the shift to daylight savings time.
Right.
And that really aligns with what you were saying, this kind of, you know, going contrary to what the natural rhythm of the season is. And in that case, literally, you know, kind of manhandling time, if you will, and our bodies do not have a good reaction to it. Mm-hmm. The most recent episode that I did of the podcast before this, I was reflecting on our culture, the dominant culture's obsession with urgency and how the apps and the technologies that we use every day are really constantly reinforcing urgency as a value. And I was juxtaposing it with this idea of our more natural rhythms and how things need time to ripen. How do you experience that kind of dissonance, cognitive dissonance? I was even using the term heart dissonance in that episode of wanting to follow a possibly meandering creative yearning that can't be put on a schedule versus all of this kind of external messaging about urgency and productivity and efficiency. I think it's, you know, related to what we were just talking about, but I think I'm wondering, I guess, sort of a deeper cut of how you experience that in terms of, oh, I want to follow this creative impulse or this creative project. And, you know, then here's everything happening in the external world that is trying to keep you on some type of rigorous schedule.
I feel, listening to you talk about this, I feel so fortunate that I've actually been free of a lot of external pressure around urgency for quite some time. So I used to have sort of more regular jobby jobs working in the nonprofit world, working in community-based organizations, mostly working with youth and also international organizations, including in refugee camps. And then I worked in the meditation world for a long time, also in organizations. And even there, there can be a sense of urgency because if you're running a meditation center, which I was, you know, we're on a schedule of events every single day and classes and programs, and those all, you know, require certain structures. So it's not that I've never experienced that, but it's now been many years since I left that world and started to work just for myself teaching meditation. So you'd think running a meditation center, there wouldn't be that sense of pressure. But of course, if you have a budget and if you have staff and needs and many people showing up and demanding things, or I kind of saw it behind the curtain of the wizard. So we can have ideas about meditation teachers, but, you know, everyone is a person. So, you know, it's not that that those didn't come with challenges, but working for myself and teaching these practices and teaching retreats and spending a lot of time writing, I don't feel quite that same pressure of urgency. And I would say that I also really like to have structures, not of urgency, but of kind of scaffolding for my work. So one of the things I do as part of my creative process is I write a newsletter that's based on moon cycles. So I send it out on full moons, new moons, and last quarter moons. And now I've started a chat on the first quarter moon. And I really like having that structure. Because if I was left to my own devices and could just follow my energy to write whenever I wanted, it would be, you know, pretty messy and intermittent to the point of, you know, long gaps, which is what it was in the past. But actually having that structure, it creates less of a sense of urgency and more like the container for me to be able to show up in a way that is rhythmic and I find helpful. So yeah, so I don't feel that sense of urgency in my life anymore because I'm not attached to systems or organizations or even many people who elicit that in me.
Yeah, which is a very fortunate position to be in.
Oh, it's huge, a huge privilege, yeah.
And there is a lot, as you said, kind of creativity in constraints, right? And having a container and having rhythms. I think maybe another way to come at it or a slightly different question is, I know that you've been, and you even mentioned earlier in the interview, you've been meditating on writing a new book. And so maybe asking the question in terms of, you know, you have this big new creative project that you are interested in investing in and are already starting to explore perhaps. And there is a model where, you know, you could put together a book proposal and go get a book deal and then be on a schedule for that book. Or there's kind of another way to go about it. And how are you thinking about that in terms of how you want to approach the creative rhythm or even the creative exploration of this kind of big, new, very deep creative project?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because maybe the last time most recently that I had that sense of urgency was with my last book. And I wrote that book in a year. So I put together a proposal and, you know, got an offer and ignorantly signed a contract to deliver it within a year. And because I'm such a rule follower, I did that. And I do not recommend that for my worst enemy. Like, it was so grueling to write a book in a year while I was also teaching retreats and teaching online and traveling and in a training program. I mean, it was really, really nuts and not good for me, you know, not good for my health, not good for my relationships, not good for a lot of things. So this time I have no, I'm not putting any kind of expectations on myself in terms of time. So I don't have plans to write a proposal until I feel like I know what I want to write about and if I want to write a proposal. And rather, I'm really allowing myself to just explore this idea, explore the craft of writing, which is something that I care a lot about and have not paid as much attention to, did not pay a lot of attention to with my last book, although I did have sort of a craft process with a friend of mine who was also writing a book, and we would meet pretty regularly throughout that year and give each other feedback on our writing, which was so helpful and allowed me to at least practice with craft a bit. She was doing a lot of fiction writing as well as this nonfiction book she was working on. So she helped me a lot with sort of storytelling parts of the book or any parts of my book that have memoir elements to them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really, because I'm looking to write a hybrid memoir this time, you know, my last book was more self-help. Really want to explore what it means to pay attention to craft in a deeper way and really take my time with the writing process so that it's something that I can feel really excited about and proud of and interested in terms of finding my writing voice. I spend a lot of time writing kind of what I consider essays. And I want to see what other things I might like to write. I don't know what that will look like or feel like or sound like in the end.
I'm curious to ask you a question specifically about this idea of voice. I just wrapped up teaching a course about finding the voice, and that was in a very broad sense, like how do we lean into deeper self-expression? And I'm curious to ask you about it specifically with regard to writing. I feel like, as you mentioned, you know, you write a weekly essay for your newsletter, which is maybe the most central way that I get to encounter your voice on a regular basis. But I also really notice that your marketing materials, your descriptions for your courses and the workshops that you offer, the tone and the voice just feels very authentic to me and very specific to you. I always have the sense that you are kind of doing whatever it is, articulating it your way and not really conforming to someone else's idea of how to market the things that you're offering. How do you think about or approach the idea of authenticity in your more personal writing and also the marketing stuff?
That's another good question. You know, I think it's all writing to me. And I remember actually when this clicked for me, it's when I was writing the book proposal and I'd been writing a newsletter for some time. Actually, that's how my agent initially found me. And I had found my voice for that pretty early on because I really treated it like just writing an email. I mean, my first newsletter was literally an email to friends because that was the only people who signed up for it. So I never lost that voice. I never tried to find a more kind of authoritative voice. It's also my teaching voice. So the way I teach meditation and teach all my offerings is really just showing up how I am. I'm not trying to be, you know, any more and hopefully less awakened than I am. Just kind of sharing kind of what I know and how I know it, and being really real about that. And have come to feel that people appreciate that. So I keep doing it. And so everything I write ends up like that. When I was writing the book proposal, I'd been given examples of book proposals to try. And I ended up taking it, and I kept trying to write this proposal. And my agent was like, yeah, it's not really working. And she recommended me to take this class on proposal writing. And it was in that class, I don't remember what happened or how, but I realized that I wasn't writing it in my voice. Like, I was writing the proposal as sort of like a book report, you know, because that's how they were all written. And I kind of switched to writing it the way I write my emails and, you know, anything else. And it came together. And for me, that means including humor and, you know, a lot of self-deprecation and just honesty and throwing in, you know, big words, but also slang and just writing in the way that I speak and the way that I am. And so I do that with everything now. And I think in my memoir writing, what I'm trying to understand is how to do that and also tell a good story.
Yeah. Right?
Whereas in my essay writing, I'm just sort of explaining things. In memoir writing, I want to you know, bring people into scenes and into story, but in a way that I don't lose that authentic voice of mine.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Your response is making me think, you know, people always say with writing, you know, to be yourself, to write what you know. And I think often about how, I mean, of course, that is really good advice, and how difficult it is to be yourself. It's sort of often said as if like that's the easiest thing to do. But I think in many ways, it's the most difficult thing to do. And what it was making me think about as I was listening to you was how much potentially, you know, your decades of experience meditating and being with yourself and getting to know yourself, how much of that flowed into your writing and into your voice in a way that didn't necessarily get practiced through writing itself, but was already honed when you maybe, you know, decided to devote yourself to that more fully.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, there's a way in which this practice of meditation is so much about knowing ourselves well and knowing our minds and being able to see clearly rather than just in an automated way of being that can be quite unconscious and in our patterns. And so a lot of what I do write about is like being able to see the patterns that I didn't see before, you know, and sharing that. And then I think that the next step for me, or the process I've been in through as I develop as a writer, is then to understand how to best express that.
Kind of continuing to pull this thread of thinking about being yourself and finding your voice, I'm also thinking about honing in on your purpose or honing in on your work. And you and I were talking maybe a few weeks ago, and you said something to me about preparing for the year ahead and kind of thinking about this strong astrological shift of Pluto moving into Aquarius for the next 20 or so years, thinking about this being a very contentious presidential election year here in the US, the ongoing wars, strife, the genocide. And I asked you after the fact, how are you preparing? Because I was curious how one could prepare. And you said something to the effect of you were thinking about what is mine to do. And I'm curious if you could say a little bit more about that, thinking about what is mine to do in this particular moment in time.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm still in the process of understanding what is mine to do, and it's probably also always shifting.
Yeah.
But I can, like many of us, feel like I'm not doing enough, mm-hmm. and or see what others are doing and think that I should be doing that rather than what is mine to do. And a lot of how I understand what is mine to do is by the responses I get. So feeling from others that what I'm offering is actually helping them understand themselves better, supporting them in their own work. You know, the feedback I get from the writing that I do, and knowing that it sustains people who are doing work, quote unquote, in the trenches, though I really think we should move away from war metaphors. So in the world. And, you know, I think because I did a lot of community-based social justice work that was really on the ground, working directly with people for so long, that sometimes I can underestimate the power of expression that I'm involved in now, because I mostly teach online and because I'm reaching people through words electronically, it can feel abstract or disconnected or non-impactful. And so one of the ways I understand what is mine to do is by recognizing that I'm having an impact, and that comes back to me in the form of feedback. Because I can't really know if it's helping or not in any other way, because they're not sort of measurable or visible impacts in the way that, you know, work I used to do mm-hmm. is or was, and really trusting that is enough. You know, that orientation towards the messages that I want to put out in the world, which are about showing up with clarity and vision for interconnection and for understanding our impact on each other and the world, and orienting ourselves towards ways of being and realities that honor our differences, but also our interrelatedness, and to just continue to plug that message. You know, sometimes I feel like I can be one note, that I'm just basically telling the story of my first book over and over again. But I don't think we can hear that message enough, you know, that, you know, the central paradox that I keep pushing is that we're not separate and we're not the same. And both of those things are important. And so we have to look at those differences, including the historical realities that got us here, and to understand those and untangle them and heal them. But we also need to really emphasize our interconnection, our interrelatedness, and just, you know, keep pushing that message.
Yeah, I don't think we can receive that message enough times in this moment in time, with all of the polarization that is happening. And I wanted to ask you that question because, in a way, that kind of reframe that you gave me feels so connected to what you're describing as your work, this kind of zooming out and reframing. When I was thinking about, well, how are you preparing? It's like, you know, you have like an image of making a list or getting something together, you know, but it was like, no, it's, I'm thinking about what is mine to do. This is like a much kind of more zoomed out perspective. And I think it's so interesting what you said about how you, you know, keep learning or keep refining or keep knowing what is yours to do through the responses that you get, through that feedback that you get. Because I think so often we have this idea that we're going to figure out our purpose, figure out what is ours to do on our own, and like then we're going to go do it. But I love how you're emphasizing the importance of reflection. I was having a conversation with someone many months ago, and it was with an animal communicator, and we were talking about pets, and they were talking about how pets are such reflectors, how they really show you your reflection. And one of the things that they said is, seeing yourself is not enough. You need that reflection. And I love thinking about that in the context of understanding what is mine to do, what is my thing, you know, my small piece to focus on, that emerges, you know, not like figuring it out in isolation per se, but in making your efforts and putting them out and kind of, you know, sending these little pings out into the world and then seeing what gets reflected back, seeing what's really landing with people, seeing what's really helping people, and seeing where your work gets acknowledged. That was kind of bringing us full circle back to the beginning of the conversation, the role of looking backwards or reflecting back and an acknowledgement in helping us refine what is ours to do.
I love that. And there's something about that resonance, you know, it's like when I can find what's resonant for me that feels really aligned and attuned to the things that I believe are going to help us collectively wake up, and that vibration resonates with others. Like it feels like this kind of resonating energy that is like this feedback loop. And so being a little part of that is sort of, yeah, the ways that I know that sort of attuning people to a different frequency that we need.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So before we wrap up, I wanted to ask if there was perhaps just one question that you might want to share with listeners to reflect on in closing, maybe something that you've been reflecting on or sitting with or mulling over lately, something that you think is worth chewing on at this particular moment in time.
I took a clowning workshop last week, which was really uncomfortable and really good. And I didn't know clowning was like a spiritual practice, basically. But one of the things that came up for me in the final exercise is that the teacher pointed out that I was not paying attention to the laughs I was getting. And I admitted that I was paying attention to people who were not laughing, which is like a no-no for clowns, right? I mean, maybe master clowns, but, you know, they'll let go to the people who are kind of grumpy. But, you know, especially in the beginning, she was like, why are you not going towards the love? Mm. And I was just like, oh, God. Read me up and down, lady. Yeah, and it just became this question for me. And yeah, go where the love is sort of like a mantra now. It's like, why don't we go towards the love? Like, or where are you not going towards the love? In what ways am I not going towards the love? So that's kind of a question for me right now.
Hmm. I love that. Thank you so much. That's a beautiful place to end. It's been a few weeks since I recorded this episode with Sebane now, and I have to say that her question has really been sticking with me. It has been attuning me to and asking me to examine all of the myriad ways in which I am not going towards the love. So I hope it stays with you too and helps you orient. maybe even just a little bit more towards opening your heart and towards trusting that the universe has your back. As I mentioned at the top of this episode, I am launching a new community and creative incubator that is very near and dear to my heart in just a few weeks. It's called Kiln, and it's really going to be both a catalyst and a container for creative transformation. To hear more about that, to stay in the loop on all of my offerings, and or to get a thoughtful essay and a bunch of provocative links on the topics of creativity and consciousness, you can sign up for my newsletter, which I send out twice a month at hurryslowly.co/newsletter. As always, thank you so much for listening, and remember to take your time.